Teenagers here in the nation's capital face especially tough odds finding work. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in Washington, D.C., nearly half of the young people looking for work can't find a job. That's the highest rate in the country. There is a program trying to address this problem, training teens in the construction trades. Last week, those trainees were part of a blitz build, aiming to rebuild a gutted house in a single day. NPR's Yuki Noguchi was there.
It's nice weather for a blitz build. It's dry and temperate. Jim Beck is development director for Sasha Bruce Youth Work, a program that helps troubled teens. He surveys all the work that needs to be done to transform this shell of a building into what will be a three-bedroom brick house for homeless youth.
We're looking at where a bathroom will be, and they're framing up the spot where we'll be putting a tub later today.
Many of the 120 volunteers are in Washington for the American Institute of Architects Conference. They stream in and out carrying mostly donated lumber and tools. The day's tasks include installing new floors and windows, laying brick on an addition, and building a greenhouse and garden.
Sort of like extreme home makeover.
I know. Only those shows, they don't really let you know all the stuff that goes on before they go on camera. There's a lot of prep that has to go in.
Prep that includes training Domingo Williams. Williams is a lanky 18-year-old who's getting his GED online while training for what he hopes will lead to a job in construction.
And I helped make this right here, so...
Scaffold.
I think that is what it's called. I'm not sure.
William spends his spare time writing poetry and music, but he's not a man of many words until you get him talking about the upstairs of the house where Williams and his fellow trainees spent the past few weeks tearing down walls and clearing debris.
And this right here, at first they was old. We had to knock them out. They was old and rusty.
So do you look at it now and you think, oh, this is nice and clean?
Yeah, like when I first came up here like this, I was scared. I thought it was raccoons up here and all that. But I can't wait to see how it's going to look when it's finished.
There are some jobs William says he's not equipped for, like working on the roof in the rain or the summer heat.
Raining and all that outside, and they still up there.
Were you up there?
No, I ain't go up there.
Williams is among about 20 remaining trainees in a class that started off with 35 teens. Tina Rose Brown is a career counselor with the program.
We're trying to weed out the young people who we feel may not be ready to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning and hit a hammer or to follow rules that include pulling up your pants and making sure you use workplace-friendly language.
Just then, Brown's cell phone buzzes.
Give me a second, this is actually reminding people now.
Yes, brother.
It's one of the trainees, stranded and asking for someone to come pick him up.
Can somebody pick you up by the Popeyes?
We don't really have nobody who can come down here and get you, Adrian. Everybody's here already, working. Adrian, please, it's almost 11.
These are the perils of training teens for the work world. Kara Fuller is the director of the training program.
Oh, man. That's probably one of our largest challenges is getting people here on time. It's like construction does not start at 1 o'clock, okay? Like you need to get up and get here, which is the really discussion is about what time you go to bed.
Fuller and the other instructors say they spend a lot of time helping the teens manage the realities of their lives, a lack of transportation or problems at home.
It's not the hard skills, it's the soft skills that really you have to work on, because you can teach someone how to use a hammer, but if they can't get there on time with a good attitude, you're not going to get it.
The Youth Build program is trying to place 10 to 15 of their current trainees in internships they hope will lead to full-time jobs. 80% of their alumni are currently employed or have gone on to more schooling. Domingo Williams says he's optimistic about his chances of getting a job, especially after he gets his certification. By late afternoon, the day's blitz build is declared a success. An addition that started the day bare is now laid with brick. Empty spaces in the wall now have windows, and there is a functioning greenhouse and garden.
Do you think you'll ever want to build your own house?
Maybe though.
Construction is due to finish on the house in July, targeting a fall move-in date. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
An American corporation best known for its association with paper is trying to turn itself around in the digital age. Leading Xerox through this transformation is a woman who's experienced her own share of change. Ursula Burns joined the company right out of college. As a top executive a decade ago, she helped pull Xerox back from the verge of bankruptcy. When she became CEO in 2009, Xerox was doing better, but the economy was struggling to come out of a deep recession. Ursula Burns is now the rarest of corporate leaders, an African-American and a woman heading a Fortune 500 company. She joined us to talk about her company and her career. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm very pleased to be with you.
It is graduation season, and for a lot of graduates, their working life begins with an internship. You started as an intern 32 years ago at Xerox. Tell us who you were then, and would you have ever dreamed that you would be CEO of Xerox one day?
I was a pretty fresh, rough engineer, and I was born and raised in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, so I was Lower East Side of Manhattan mechanical engineer descending on this great American corporation called Xerox Corporation. And what I found there was an organization that accepted me for whom I was. They actually tried to round out some edges without taking away the person that they hired. You know, my impatience, my quote-unquote bravado, all of the, you know, they actually accepted all of that. Now, I didn't think when I walked into the company that I would be the CEO. I did expect to be successful, though. My mother raised us to think that if we worked hard and if we put our end of the bargain in, it would work out okay for us. And I loved the place. They seemed to like me well enough. So a marriage was formed, and, you know, I've been there ever since.
You know, you mentioned the Lower East Side back in 1980, approximately. It wasn't the fancy sort of East Village area that it is today.
No, the Lower East Side, when I was growing up, was the ghetto. It was tough. It was drug-infested. So my mother created, in this environment that, you know, wasn't great when you walked out the door, she created an environment that was just fine inside. And she spent a lot of money to send my sister, my brother, and I to Catholic school. It's the best education that we could get at that time. But when I think about it in hindsight, it was just fine. I was never wanting for encouragement, that's for sure.
You know, I wonder then, was there a moment ever where you found that being a woman was a hurdle for you as you moved up?
Race and gender definitely came up occasionally in my life at work. But the bigger challenge that I had was age. I took roles earlier in my career than people expected. And so a lot of what I got was, do you actually know enough to do this? Gender and race, as you move up, this idea of looking the part becomes more of a challenge when you don't look the part. But, you know, there's nothing I can do or wanted to do about being a black female. I kind of like both of those things. So at the end of the day, the people who were around me had to do a little bit more adjusting to that than I did. I did no adjusting to that. Now, I got beat up for doing bad things or not moving fast enough, but never for being a woman or for being black. It's just not a part of the way that we operated it. You know, I benefited from that for sure. It was a great place to start.
As CEO, you are in the midst of transforming this iconic company that's been known or is known for copiers, so much so that Xeroxing means copying. Give us an example of one of the things that Xerox does now that's very big for the company that many of us out here wouldn't have a clue that you were doing.
Yeah, I'll give you two examples. One, transportation. So a lot of people enjoy the benefit of Easy Pass, which means when you go through a toll, you don't have to stop and
right.
Put cash into those things, et cetera.
Yeah, for toll roads and things
the
like
toll
that.
Toll roads, right. Xerox manages the infrastructure for Easy Pass for a large number of states. So when you say Easy Pass and get some bill from Easy Pass or call and ask a question about Easy Pass, you're talking to a Xerox person. If you get a ticket for running a red light in certain states around this nation, Xerox actually provides the installation and management of the camera systems, but the back office system to assure that we're sending the ticket to the right place, et cetera, et cetera. So we do everything from customer care infrastructures, finance and accounting infrastructures, to Medicaid back office systems. And what I'm leading now is a broadening back to where we started. First one was copying, now we're into transportation and so on and so forth.
And circling back, because in these last decades, Xerox went through a rough patch.
Yeah.
It needed maybe less visibility and more viability.
The world is changing. We all know this. And as that world changes, if you don't transform your company, you're stuck. I mean, Even if you could figure out a way to be profitable and reasonably successful, I think you would be underusing your assets if you don't figure out a way to become more relevant as the world transforms and evolves. And that's what a big piece of what a CEO does. And so as we look at our mission now, just like our mission was when we started, our mission was to automate work processes. We became so good at this one business process that we didn't think about all the rest of them that were out there. And so as the market started to change, and as customers said, can you do more for us? They also said, hey, can you manage, you know, you're already engaged here. Why don't you get engaged with the statement of benefit forms? Why don't you generate the thing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think it was a really easy transformation from that standpoint, because we didn't have to go from making food to making airplanes. It's pretty close. It was in our neighborhood.
You know, Xerox now has nearly 140,000 employees. More than half of those employees are operating out of the United States. And I'm wondering if, do you think corporations like Xerox have an obligation to provide jobs for Americans?
This idea about a responsibility is an interesting statement. Xerox, as an American company, has a responsibility to have jobs in the U.S., but we also have a huge business in the U.K. I have responsibility to have jobs in the U.K. I have a growing business in India. I have a responsibility to have jobs in India. I have a big business in Russia, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't look at it as myopically or as single-focused as providing jobs in the U.S. only. I think that because we are here, I will bring back jobs. We do bring back jobs. We bring jobs into the United States as long as the U.S. can continue to be competitive, and we can. We are an innovative group of people in the United States, so we can be competitive in both cost, but also in quality and, as I said, in innovativeness.
Ursula Burns is the CEO for Xerox. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
As politicians press their agendas, they make every possible use of news events around the world. And in the case we'll discuss next, rival politicians draw opposite conclusions from the same news. European leaders are meeting today in Brussels.
Election results in France and Greece have been building momentum for a change in Europe's response to its debt crisis. Austerity has prevailed until now, but the new pressure is for policies that encourage economic growth. Here in the U.S., Republicans and Democrats have their own interpretations of the crisis, as NPR's David Wellna reports.
If you listen to House Speaker John Boehner speaking here on ABC TV over the weekend, the grand lesson to be drawn from the crisis in Europe is this. Very bad things can happen when a nation's debt gets too high.
People aren't clamoring to invest in Greece today. And if we don't begin to deal with our debt and our deficit in an honest and serious way, we're not going to have many options.
Cliff Stearns, a Florida Republican who's a member of the House Tea Party Caucus, considers Europe a clear warning for the U.S.
I think the lesson to be learned is that we need to reduce spending here, or we'll run into the same situation.
But Democrats in Congress have a very different takeaway from Europe's woes, namely that austerity has only made matters worse. Barney Frank is the top Democrat on the House Financial Services Committee.
It's not an accident that the American economy is outperforming all of the European economies, including England, where they've put in severe austerity, because we have resisted that severe austerity and have done more spending.
And President Obama, after meeting with Europe's leaders this week in Chicago, called for a balanced approach to the euro crisis that very much resembles his own, a commitment to long-term fiscal discipline while pursuing growth in the short term.
The good news was you saw a consensus across the board, from newly elected President Hollande to Chancellor Merkel to other members of the European community, that balanced approach is what's needed right now.
Even some who've questioned many of the president's other economic policies agree with him on this one. Here's U.S. Chamber of Commerce President Tom Donohue at a breakfast panel earlier this week.
You can't control costs without growth. You can't, particularly in this country, you'll never going to be able to put 5 more million people we've got to put back to work without growth.
I think people are realizing that what's going on in Europe now isn't working.
That's UC Berkeley economics professor Christina Romer, who earlier chaired President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. She says Europe's economic medicine has been killing the sick patients.
Asking them to immediately cut their budget deficit is surely bad policy. It is making their unemployment rate higher. It's making it harder for them to get their deficit under control.
And that lesson, says Harvard economist Kenneth Rogoff, should not be lost on the U.S.
Clearly, if you tighten the budget now in the middle of this recession, or even if we weren't, it's probably going to have a short-term negative effect on growth.
In the end, according to C. Fred Bergston, who directs the Peterson Institute for International Economics, what really distinguishes Europe from the U.S. is a question of urgency.
If the markets are voting against you, if you can't borrow at sustainable interest rates, then you have no choice but to put your house in order. That's Greece and some of the other Europeans. If you're still getting money very cheaply, if you can finance your budget deficits easily, like the United States, you've got more time.
Which may also be why Congress has been putting off a lot of hard decisions. David Wellman, NPR News, The Capitol.
NPR's business news starts with new warnings of recession. The Congressional Budget Office says the U.S. economy could fall back into a recession if Washington doesn't address the looming fiscal crisis. The warning came in a report issued yesterday. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The CBO report says a number of things are scheduled to happen at the end of this year that will have a serious impact on the economy. The Bush-era tax cuts are supposed to expire, as is a temporary reduction in the payroll tax. Meanwhile, deep cuts in federal spending are supposed to take place automatically if Congress and the White House can't agree on a debt reduction plan. The report says the cuts and the tax increases will bring more money into the Treasury and lower the federal budget deficit by as much as 4%. But it says higher taxes and less federal spending will also weaken the economy, lowering incomes and raising unemployment. In that case, the report says the U.S. economy could shrink by 1.3% during the first half of 2013 and then rebound slowly in the second half. The report makes clear there are no easy solutions to the problem. It says extending the tax cuts and spending more would be better for the economy, but would also increase the deficit over the long run. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.